Accession number 30286, reel 3.
Bill Jones, reel 3.
Right. Before we went on towards Ceylon, we were sent up to again tie up with 39 Squadron. Having been briefed to attack a convoy, which I think was on its way to Malta. And the lads were briefed to attack the convoy and then land at Malta. And we asked a group captain who was doing the briefing if there was any likelihood of Messerschmitt 109 fighters being about. And he said, don't be a damn fool. Do you think we'd be such fools to send you out if there were? Well, they found the convoy and attacked it, getting 4 torpedo hits despite being attacked by 109s. And all except one got away and headed for Malta. Then at Malta, they were met by dozens of ME-109Fs, the latest Jerry fighter. Shot down all the aircraft, and the crews were gunned down in the water when they got out of the aircraft, swimming in the water, life belts. So they were all gunned down by the Germans, and once one or two got to the shoreline and the cliffs at Malta and were gunned down as they tried to get up the cliffs. Now, we were not involved in that by pure chance, because our aircraft was unserviceable, so we borrowed somebody else's, and on the way out to sea, it started vibrating so badly that it simply wasn't sensible or safe to continue. So we had to turn back, and if we hadn't turned back, then I wouldn't be talking to you today. And we all thought it was really disgraceful that the Germans had shot people in the who were in the water.
What was the next stage for you, sir?
So the next stage was to go back to Alexandria. And then on to move on to Ceylon. This was in April 1942. And then we went via Iraq. We went in various stages. One stage was Iraq. We left Suez. After leaving Suez, we headed up the coast of Palestine and started to climb to get over a range of mountains 4,000 feet high, which is very high for us. We were used to flying at 0 feet. It was a long time since we'd been over 2,000 feet. But it was interesting to see. And then this is still on our way to Iraq, I think. And we were, as I say, high over 4,000 feet over these mountains. We followed an oil pipeline through the desert, and suddenly we ran slap into the dickens of a dust storm. Now, we were in formation, but it was a wide formation, and we lost each other straight away as we got in the dust storm. And we climbed about another 2,000 feet to make sure we didn't collide with anybody who was at our original height. And the visibility closed right down. We tried to climb above the muck. We went up to 10,500 feet to get into clear air. And by now it was just about time we were expected to arrive, our ETA, estimated time of arrival. And we heard our destination, which was Habania, send out a visibility report of 50 yards. So we asked them for an up-to-date report and got 1,000 yards. So I said to myself, right, out and down we go. So we were given a bearing to get to where we wanted to go. And we glided down on it through the fog, and the crew could just make out the ground as we got to about 6,000 feet, though I couldn't see it. And so as the ground came into view, we could see the River Euphrates, and we got down. We found Lake Habania. Visibility was getting worse again, so I made a sort of dart at the aerodrome and got down first time. A little bit of a dicey do, but all eight of the aircraft arrived safely, which we thought was a very good performance in those circumstances. Now, we had to stay at Habania for 4 weeks altogether because Don caught a mild dose of dysentery involving a stay in hospital. So we were behind the others. We were left on our own while the others went on. But I remember when one of our chaps landed, he started talking to the ground crew who were stationed at Habania, and he asked one of them if the climate was healthy. "Oh, yes, sir, very," he said. "When I was in bed for a month with diphtheria, I gained 10 pounds.
What were conditions like there?
Oh, very pleasant. It was very hot. We bathed in the lake, which was very good. It was an agreeable break. And there was a good mess there, and it was very pleasant, though very hot. And then we went on to Shaibar, which was infernally hot. Believed to be one of the hottest places on earth, I think. A really sticky kind of heat. Sparrows go about with their beaks open, panting.
How long were you in Shaibar?
About a month.
All right.
Until we had one bit of trouble with the aircraft, the old 6525 symptoms. It wouldn't maintain height properly, and the ground. So we having taken off, we had to land again. Took the luggage out to lighten the load a bit, and ground crew tried. The engine started surging a bit. One of the engines didn't happen when the ground crew tried it. Of course, that's par for the course. And took it again the following morning. The same result. So, up against the same problem as the old 6525. And all the squadron leader and group captain who'd never seen a Beaufort before, let alone flown one, were going around muttering to themselves, "Trouble is this blankety pilot can't blankety well fly." That's what it is. Said a bald old, it's against the whole theory of flight, said a bald old coot of a squadron leader engineer officer. Difficulty was, of course, that I was the only Beaufort pilot there, so I was the only one who could know about it.
And do you get this sometimes with aircraft, that certain ones just have a problem that you can't solve, and
yes,
there's no reason
no,
or right
nobody
for
seems
it
to know why. But in fact, so we risked it, and we went on to the next station. And in fact, it was found, their ground crew there found that what they call the distance piece in the tail had come loose and was responsible for the aircraft shuddering and not flying properly. So I sent a signal back to the engineer officer to tell him why it was. Then we went off for Karachi, was the next stop. Uneventful trip there, with another night stopover. And in each stop, the aircraft were thoroughly checked by the ground crew, who were very good indeed. We were very well served by the ground crew who were stationed at these various places. Karachi was dusty and sticky. And then next stage was to Hyderabad. Now, again, with difficult visibility, but we had no difficulty in finding Hyderabad, or to correct it, the name Secunderabad, I think it was, aerodrome, and even less difficulty in landing there. Though we'd been warned that it was an awkward aerodrome. When the others had gone through, they'd had a lot of trouble with one of them having to do what they call a ground loop. In other words, if you're coming to the end of the runway and you haven't stopped, you have to shove everything, put your rudder off full on, and open up one engine to get round in a sort of loop to face the other way.
What was awkward about it? Was it a short runway?
A short runway. But fortunately, we didn't have any difficulty. Then the next stage was to Ceylon itself, as it then was, Sri Lanka now, of course. Uneventful trip. We found the east coast of India appearing on our port side. The further we flew, the clearer it became. And then we flew across the chain of narrow islands separating India from Ceylon. And as we approached Ceylon, I remember the clouds beginning to roll up beneath us, and we went down through them to about 400 feet to get underneath them, so that was slightly dicey. And then we found the Ceylon coast and followed it along to get to Ratmalan, was the station that we were. We were bypassed Colombo itself, and then found Ratmalan and landed. And of course the others were all there already, so everything had been prepared for us. We weren't involved with getting things ready when we landed. All there.
What was Ratmalan like as a station?
Ratmalan, well, it was like several stations in Ceylon. It consisted of one runway in the middle of, cut out of the middle of palm trees, and you only need one runway whereas in England you had triangular runways because you didn't know which way the wind was going to blow. You always had to take off and land into the wind. In Ceylon, the monsoon seasons, the wind blows either one way or the other, straight up or straight down. So you just had one long run, one long runway, and then you had sort of huts to live in, bamboo, palm leaf huts. I did some drawings of them, but can't show you those. And fair enough, quite pleasant.
Had the threat at this stage of the Japanese that you mentioned was the original reason for you going, had that kind of declined a little bit, the threat in the Indian Ocean?
No, the threat was there all the time. And as I said earlier, that's why we were sent there. And although they didn't in fact make another attack, the threat was always possible.
And was your role then, at that stage, would your role have been built to attack any Japanese shipping that was seen?
It would. Or aircraft, for that matter.
How did you spend your time while you were there then?
Oh, gosh. It's very difficult to remember. I suppose we did a lot of training flying. A lot of practice flying. I remember a lot of night flying for practice. And we did exercises with the Navy. The Navy had some ships in the area, and then we did some dummy attacks on them to help with information for both the Navy and for ourselves. And there was quite mountainous. Ceylon is quite mountainous, of course. Lanka is quite mountainous. And I remember one night training flight we were doing, and there was a huge upsurge of wind, a huge gust of wind, which took us up near to the mountains. This was took us up 6,000 feet in a matter of seconds. But that was all right.
Did you fly any anti-submarine patrols at all at that stage?
Any?
Anti-submarine patrols?
Yes, we did. Yes, we did some anti-submarine patrols. We didn't see any submarines, though.
How long would they be, roughly?
I imagine you'd probably be out for 2 or 3 hours over the sea.
And what kind of... Would you fly a box pattern or a search pattern or something to look for them?
I'm afraid I can't remember. Probably, yes. Yes, you probably would. I'm afraid I can't remember.
Did you have any leave while you were in?
Any?
Leave in Ceylon?
Yes, we did. Yes, I remember being... I think we had a cricket match on the Colombo cricket ground. That's a very vague recollection. I'm not sure. I recollect vaguely saying, because I was a bit of a cricketer. We had at one stage, together with a chap from another squadron, 30 squadron, I think. We were sent up to Kandy in the hills with the object of umpiring, from an RAF point of view, some army invasion exercises. That was quite interesting. And we... we got a driver and a car and went up through very beautiful country. We were at the umpires conference and we liaised with the army, and we weren't obviously very impressed with the army generally at that stage, but we had very useful talks to generals and brigadiers, and we gave a written and fairly candid report. And it was taken very well and commented on very favourably by a couple of brigadiers. So we thought we'd done a good job there.
So you weren't the only ones who probably had those thoughts about the performance of the army.
Indeed. Yes, we had hockey matches in the... amongst the various flights at around Malana. I was a hockey player. I played for England. And so I was captain of our flight team. And we managed to beat everybody else with a bit of guidance from me. that's other things. Vague recollection of playing golf. So all the various things that you do to pass the time.
So there was lots of recreational activities available to when you were off duty.
Yes, indeed.
How long were you in Ceylon for?
That's a good question. I think it was until late 1943.
I've got... Oh, I see here, August... Was it August 43 you left for Britain?
August 42. sorry, August 42, we were doing practice torpedo dropping in Ceylon, 42.
You've got here, it must be the end of August 43 we left to go back to Britain.
Must have been, yes. Yes, it must have been. That's right. Yes, because my logbook shows that I was flying again in this country on November the 27th, 1943, so I was back in England by then.
How do you look back on your time in Ceylon?
Well, it's very enjoyable, really, in retrospect. There were a very nice lot of chaps in the squadron. We all got on very well. And I remember one of the sergeants, who was a bit of an electrician, set up a sort of camp radio, which was very successful. I did a lot of concert party stuff. I was a bit of an entertainer, and so that was part of the setup.
And how long had your tour lasted? How long was a tour in Coastal Command at that stage?
Well, I think a tour was either 2 years or 200 hours flying, operational flying. But of course, we weren't doing operational flying because it wasn't needed.
So that period, that would be your period of
that
time
was the
that
tour,
you was there?
Yes. By the time I got back, I had done a tour, though not, in fact, much in the way of operations.
What happened when you returned to the UK? Were you off flying for a period? Or did you have a different role?
In March 44, we were converted to bow fighters from Beauforts.
And were you still with 22 Squadron?
No. We did some more operational training I can't remember where it was.
Oh, actually. Was this with 132
Turnbull in Scotland, yeah. Professional torpedo training.
And that role with the bullfighter, was that again as a strike aircraft?
Yes,
torpedoes?
Yes, torpedoes or rockets. We had rockets, and I never, in fact, dropped a torpedo in action. But we did do rocket attacks.
What was your impressions of the bullfighter as an aircraft?
Oh, a lovely aircraft, very good aircraft. A crew of only one besides me, pilot and navigator, air gunner. And it was a very good aircraft again, good workmanlike aircraft, faster, of course, and a bit more manoeuvrable.
Was it easy to handle with that manoeuvrability, or did it have any? Was that an aircraft with any vices?
No, again, it worked very well. A good aircraft.
And as you say, they were armed with torpedoes, rockets, or did you have cannon at all on the aircraft?
I think it probably was cannon, actually. Again, I'm trying to remember. I can't remember precisely. I think it was... we certainly did have cannon, I think. But... pause. So I joined 254 Squadron at Northcote, near Grimsby. And we did a lot of patrolling along the French Dutch coasts, hoping to find shipping to attack. There was an awful lot of patrolling with no actual action. But presumably we might have had the result of keeping ships in harbour.
Would you fly single patrols or in formation?
We would sometimes be on our own and sometimes in formation. And then we did attacks on one notable harbour was Den Helder in Holland. And that was one of the regular places that we attacked. And we would do that as a squadron in formation to get there.
Is there a technique for attacking a ship that you would do with a Beaufort? Is it a matter of going straight for your target, or
yes,
do you have an approach?
Straight for the target. Straight for the target. There was one wing commander who ended up as a vice marshal, Taken, I think, Bill Taken, an Australian or New Zealander, who devised a system. I never found out about this, but I heard about it afterwards, of firing his cannon shells until he could see them hitting the bottom of the ship, and then firing his rockets. And that was a brilliant ploy. There was a big obituary of him in the Times not all that long ago. But normally we would just go straight for the target.
And would you release all your rockets at once if you were attacked, or would you release them in groups?
I really can't remember. So my memory's all rather vague of what actually happened. I can remember sort of going in towards the harbour, and I can remember green and yellow flak coming up past me. Got hit in the tail once, but there was no real damage, and I was very lucky. I had things went my way.
Was the harbour heavily defended then?
Oh yes.
What kind of height would you attack there?
Oh, that would be low. You'd be quite low down.
So am I right in thinking the sensation of attacking that? You're really very much over the target, or incredibly quickly in a way again.
Oh yes, that's right. Yeah.
And what were relationships like with your air gunner wireless operator? How did you get over?
Oh, fine. His name was Jack Kelway, and he was fine. He was a good navigator.
Did it seem a little strange in that kind of environment that you were in the bullfighter? Because it's all, in some respects, it almost seems to me like almost like a single engine aircraft that has a wireless operator, as opposed to having a crew like you had with the bullfighter.
Yes. Oh. No, he was in the position to do his job. We did have one patrol which we were on our own along the French coast, I think it was. Jack said to me, "Bill, there seems to be a light following us." I thought that was funny, so I turned away to port, and the light turned with us. I turned back to starboard, and the light turned with us. So I thought, this is funny, don't like the look of this. So what I did, by pure instinct, I was about 200 feet then, was to drop down towards the sea, which I did, and pulled up again, and then the light, whatever it was, hit the sea and exploded. So it must have been one of the very earliest heat-seeking missiles, which, if we hadn't done anything, I suspect would have caught us up and blown us to bits.
Again, was that the practice to go as low to the sea
as possible?
No,
this was pure instinct to try and think of something that might tell us what this thing was.
Did you fly any sweeps towards Norway at all?
Oh yes, we did indeed go as far as Norway. It was the very longest. We had one very, very long trip to attack for naval ships, German naval ships, I think, in Norway. That was an enormous, a very limit of our range. We could only just have enough petrol to get there and back. We did a quick attack and then got back.